During the recent ASCO meeting, I met with our next speaker, Dr. Andrei Jakubowiak, to obtain an update on multiple myeloma. And to begin, we focused on one of the two classes of novel agents that has changed the natural history of this disease, proteasome inhibitors.
These are agents with proven efficacy. And we also learned over the last few years that newer agents are not only potentially useful because of different toxicity profile, which is the case for the most part, but also because of some ability to work in different patient subpopulations and in particular ability overcoming resistance. So two top next generation proteasome inhibitors after bortezomib are carfilzomib, and I think I would say MLN-970A at this point, although formerly known NPI-0052 has been for some time in development.
Now the MLN compound is oral.
So MLN compound is similar to bortezomib, but it is oral, and it's not only orally bioavailable, but has some subtle differences in its toxicity profile, which might be of very important clinical impact. I would stress only learning from bortezomib experience, which we know has one major limiting longevity of use of this drug, side effects, that is development of neuropathy. When we have heard from Dr. Moreau that subcutaneous use of the same drug, not different at all, has same efficacy, which was good news, but also decreased by about 50% impact on development of peripheral neuropathy, we kind of reinforce the significance of peak and concentration and area under the curve. And we know that even impact on efficacy may be relevant in this time, although we don't see it yet for sub-Q bortezomib.
I guess the same thing would apply to oral.
The same, even more so. And to some extent, oral proteasome inhibitor has come with, as it usually is, with some trade-offs. There is an almost certain lack of very limited peripheral neuropathy. So far, we at least know from phase one studies and also from emerging data from combination studies that that drug, when taken orally, which by the way is not necessarily exactly the same drug which is active after absorption, it is converted into active form, which is eventually distributed into the tissues. Oral drug, in short, is not really apparently causing peripheral neuropathy. We have to wait how it is after longer exposure. Patients in relapse setting are rarely staying long on this drug, but as we've heard yesterday from Dr. Lonia, there are some patients who are way over a year and a half of original doses and without emergence of neuropathy. So I think it is truly a great achievement. What is the trade-off? There is maybe higher rate of nausea and GI toxicities, and also emergence of some maybe previously noted in some situations, skin rashes, as we call it. Sometimes they look completely different, typical drug rashes. They are easily manageable. That's the good news. On the other hand, they are fairly common. Important thing is that they appear to be clearing very nicely with steroids. And if we go to the combinations, steroids will be part of the treatment with MLN-9708. So I think that would be potentially a less of a problem. And so far, we do see that that's truly abrogated as well as GI issues. So that's where we are. So on the other hand, for example, carfilzomib, no skin rashes, no really relevant significant toxicity. On the other hand, you have some impact of this drug potentially because of irreversibility of the drug and 2 day in a row infusion. So we have clearly extended period of duration of proteasome inhibitor, which we felt way, way back many years ago may be detrimental, but it may be potentially contributing to what I would perceive very good activity of this agent as a single agent in three tested to this point patient populations.
What is the infusion schedule for carfilzomib?
So carfilzomib is given 2 days in a row weekly for 3 weeks in a row in a four-week cycle. So the last week is a break. And it is established from phase one as a tolerated way of managing patients with this proteasome inhibitor.
What do we know about these two agents in terms of firstly sort of a single agent activity and also now, as you mentioned, both are being looked at in combination up front?
So more advanced research with carfilzomib. So I'll start with carfilzomib. There was a very large study which evolved with earlier phase one study, which was phase two, so without dose escalation. The study is called A1. It enrolled over 250 patients, which were, for the most part, bortezomib refractory. And there was also inclusion criteria of patients who may not have been refractory, but were bortezomib intolerant. So in a way, it was unmet need for patients who are not really able to either take bortezomib or for whom this drug is already no longer effective. And in this patient population, which was enrolled into this study, and there were patients who were for sure refractory to many other agents, double refractory in great proportion. It was a good proportion of patients refractory to all approved agents in myeloma. In short, despite this fairly pretreated 5 years from diagnosis plus median time and number of treatments, there was a clear single agent activity, to me clear, and many agree in meeting updates, and we anticipate the paper to be published in the near future, which has been in the range of what we call partial response, 50% reduction of the disease, somewhere in between high teens and 20 plus percent. But when you go to a minor response or more, which is clinically relevant, it was actually called clinical benefit, it approaches 30% for single agent in a refractory patient. To me, it was clear evidence of activity.
So maybe before we go on, just to sort of flip over to the sort of clinical human impact of this agent, can you recall specific patients that you've treated who, you know, had progressive disease in spite of conventional therapy, who had clinically meaningful responses to this agent?
Absolutely. I participated in all relevant studies with carfilzomib. In this particular one, we had a number of patients who clearly benefited against their odds, so to speak. The responses in relapsed refractory patients are, as I mentioned, not as frequent, but those who had responded had good duration of response, which have translated to approximately 7 to 8 months, which, when you are running out of option, is truly clinically relevant. But I think what I would like to maybe bring to this discussion, which may not be as critical when the drug is being reviewed by FDA for approval, specifically for that indication, but there was another study now already published in Blood Online in which we use carfilzomib in less pretreated patients, including patients not exposed to bortezomib, with all the limitation of indirect comparisons. Response rates were over 50% in these patients at the higher dose level, which we are now very comfortable to use, than in A1 study, and by indirect comparison, potentially higher than what was seen in APEX study for bortezomib as a single agent.
So can you talk about the CRD study and what you presented here at ASCO yesterday?
Yeah, and I'm happy to give some highlights of the results of this study, which, by the way, is just today put online, so it's now published after our presentation at ASCO yesterday.
That's awesome. What journal?
It's in Blood.
Great. I really like that trend towards present, publish.
We try to make it as good and as timely as possible with my ability to present the data before publication yesterday at ASCO, which was well received. But in short, we...
Same thing happened this weekend with anti-PD-1 and lung cancer. Present, publish, New England Journal.
Very happy to hear that others are successful. You know how sometimes difficult it is to time it. We were lucky because I think the data helps us to really move with this publication and coming across with the knowledge about this combination as timely, as quickly as possible. So very shortly, how this combination was developed and what was our hypothesis when we went into the study, which I think is relevant. First, we knew that constructs with proteasome inhibitor, IMiD, and dexamethasone are successful. We know it from RVD, VDT, and that these drugs are not only active, we use them commonly, most people move to 3-drug regimens, but that they are bringing deeper responses, and we learned that deeper responses in both transplant and non-transplant setting, for the statistical understanding, are predicting longer remissions and longer survival in some studies which have been recently reported. So it is important to have those drugs giving that boost of cytoreduction at the beginning, number one. Number two, we also learned, and it has been already known from the first studies with bortezomib, that the longer you keep drug, especially novel drug, the higher likelihood that this disease will be better and better reduced. We see it for bortezomib, for lenalidomide, for combinations. What we have also learned, that as old principle oncology tells us, that there is a therapeutic index which limits potential of these drugs and their combination. And many of these very powerful and good regimens, I use them a lot, have eventually emergence of some toxicities, particularly peripheral neuropathy, which forces us to reducing the dose or even discontinuation some of these drugs as we know all in our practice. And what it means that when we could potentially take advantage of these combination for a longer period of time, we have to back off, and then eventually disease reemerges, and that hurts patients. So when we learn about carfilzomib, that it does not have neuropathy as a problem and that it could be tolerated for extended period of time, we designed a study with projection that we would like to treat this patient for extended period of time. We didn't focus on elderly or transplant candidates. We actually took all the patients, but we have asked patients at the beginning, after careful discussion, that if they are transplant candidates, we will collect their stem cells, but then continue. We call this regimen CRD from carfilzomib, lenalidomide, and dex, for, as we were planning, essentially for 8 cycles of induction, and then for CRD maintenance for, we initially planned, indefinite period of time. We ended up finishing that 3-drug treatment at 24th March just for practical reasons. And that approach have allowed us to really come with the results which we have presented and now publish, that first of all, the combination is very powerful. In fact, I think the rapidity of response is close to what we have seen among the best responses so far. Already after one cycle, we have 67% reduction of the disease. After 2 cycles, 81% reduction of the disease. But what we have seen and continuously observed is continuous decline of the slope of the curve of M protein, if plotted down from day 1 to, say, cycle 12, as we shown at ASCO meeting, to close to undetectable levels or undetectable levels in many patients. But that's only M protein. But what has been really, truly important of this meeting and what we emphasize in our paper, that at 4 cycles, there was a good proportion, in fact, higher than other regimens, of near complete responses or better. But when we continue patients on treatment more, with median 12 months of follow-up or cycles of treatment, our responses are close to 100% for overall response, but VGPR is over 80%, near CR is over 70%, and complete responses, named as stringent complete responses, for entire patient population are 41%, meaning that we cannot detect disease in this patient population treated with CRD with any means, including immunofixation and with normalization of free light, in close to 50% of entire patient population. But then we analyzed it further and we looked at patients who had been on treatment longer, and those patients who received 8 cycles or more have reached, in my opinion, unmatched to this point levels of response. Near CR is 78% for this group of patients, and stringent CR is 61%. These numbers are truly comparing favorably to anything we've seen, including combination treatments with initial 3-drug regimen, then transplant, then post-transplant consolidation. As much as it is risky to make those comparisons between studies, which has been done in different times, in different patient population, for the most part, we see in newly diagnosed myeloma that those numbers are truly informative.
And it's really fascinating, the strategy that was behind this trial. Can you cite any other trial examples that had that similar strategy, particularly in the younger transplant-eligible patient?
Well, I think it is always difficult to change accepted way of thinking and doing things. And I think I remember a time when we were developing this study, there was a lot of resistance to really come with this strategy. You're right, there was a RVD study, for example, had option to continue treatment after stem cell collection and then continuing RVD, which is similar to what we have used.
But they did not have this strategy at all.
But they didn't have this strategy. They had just provided this as an option. So many investigators participating in this study, including myself, have taken transplant candidates to transplant. And as a result, they had maybe provided different signal from their study because they found that actually those two groups of patients had comparable progression-free survival. But eventually, they could not really learn what we have learned from our study, that extended treatment for majority of patient population will be more and more effective over time.
So I want to ask you what the next step is going to be in terms of trials for CRD, but what about side effects? One of the things that was kind of striking initially, I was curious about, was the dyspnea.
So dyspnea was reported in a number of studies with carfilzomib. It has been noted in a few limited cases, mostly in more advanced disease. And to some extent, it was felt to be maybe related to tumor lysis or some other similar quick cytoreduction-related effects. In our study, we agreed that dyspnea have been observed in few patients, but it was, after final analysis, a really small proportion of patients who had this problem. We felt that in some of these cases, we have been maybe overzealous, trying to prevent tumor lysis and putting patients on quite good hydration, which may have been tipping over some of the more elderly patients into some fluid overload-related dyspnea, which was self-sustained and easily correctable. And what I have come to the conclusion that this is not necessarily an ongoing drug problem. We had one patient who developed that type of issue. It was potentially limiting its duration of treatment, but all other patients, we found that they can tolerate combination of CRD in subsequent cycles without those attenuations, without any dyspnea. So it was somehow this initial treatment-related effect, which was, again, seen not only very limited, as we updated in the paper, a number of patients.
So nothing seen in the lungs, no pneumonitis?
No.
What else? I think there were some metabolic issues, were there?
To some extent, yes. There was some reports from, again, relapse patients of some increase of renal creatinine and decrease of renal function. That has, again, been not necessarily observed in our study, which is in newly diagnosed patients. We have just very limited, as you will see in the paper, number of any changes of creatinine. That has not been a really critical issue. I think that if I would put toxicity in the context, I think most common toxicities were still, to some extent, mostly mild, grade 1 or 2, decreases of hemoglobin, white blood cells, and thrombocytopenia. Again, mostly mild, with less than a fifth of the patients having grades 3 and rarely grade 4. No really a lot of cases with true grade 4 neutropenia, and only one case of neutropenic fever for entire 53-patient population. So not big of an issue. Then in non-hematologic toxicities, most common were in hypophosphatemia and hyperglycemia, mostly related to study design because we have measured chemistry the next day after dexamethasone. Those two are clearly dexamethasone-related. They were not really having any impact on patients. I don't really see any pattern other than occasionally some level of fatigue in some patients, of toxicity in patients treated with this regimen. There are some side effects here and there, sometimes attributed even to one or two drugs in the regimen, but nothing emerging as a pattern. In fact, I would flip here that patients, there were a few cases of rashes, mostly attributed to lenalidomide, which is known and predicted side effect. As I said, I would flip to say that surprisingly, and I've been practicing management of myeloma for many years and used all the modern regimens, including RVD, VDT, RVDD. I have not seen in any of the prior experiences so good tolerability of any regimen. Many of these patients on CRD have been treated for a total of 24 months, many way past 12 months. These patients, especially those in stringent responses and good responses, come to clinic over and over again having no or very mild complaints for the most part, with few exceptions. And what is also a reflection more objectively of tolerability of the regimen, overall more than 50% of patients remain on originally assigned doses, even at the end of 24 cycles, including lenalidomide, originally designed to be used at 25 milligrams for 3 weeks out of four, carfilzomib at assigned doses. More than half of the patients were at 36. So that gives you a sense how well this combination is not only working, but tolerated. Again, we are doctors, patients are different. Every patient needs to be approached with a good understanding that if toxicities emerge, there are good guidelines how to make those modifications.
What about peripheral neuropathy?
So peripheral neuropathy was observed in about 20% of patients, but it was all grade 1, with exception of two patients when they had just borderline grade 2. In all cases except one, we attributed it to lenalidomide, which is more or less in the range of what has been reported for lenalidomide, and why we think that it was correct attribution based on this assessment. Of course, that was forcing us to make lenalidomide dose reduction in these patients. And we noted improvement of this neuropathy after lenalidomide was reduced without reducing carfilzomib, which gives me, again, sense that that was maybe predominantly at least related to lenalidomide. We have to think that this is combination, whether those two agents somehow help each other in some of the side effects. That is difficult to say. But again, this is very manageable and not a problem at all in this regimen.
So one of the key clinical attributes of bortezomib in myeloma is the fact that it can be used in patients with renal failure, which is not uncommon. What do we know about carfilzomib in patients with renal dysfunction?
So in this particular study, we had enrolled patients who had initially 60 cc's per minute, and eventually we lowered it down to 50, mostly because of lenalidomide as a part of the treatment to really evaluate this drug well in this context. But we've learned that carfilzomib can be given for patients with renal insufficiency, including very advanced renal insufficiency. I think the data is still limited, and I think like with other agents, we will have to learn about that more, but that is emerging as observation.
So what clinical trials are ongoing right now looking at the CRD regimen?
The main clinical trial, which I think everybody will be looking for, is we call this trial ASPIRE trial, in which patients are treated with either CRD combination or lenalidomide and dex in a control arm in patients who relapsed after initial successful treatment. And that study enrolled over 700 patients. Interestingly, patients progressing on lenalidomide maintenance were allowed to be enrolled into this study on both arms, assuming that lenalidomide in maintenance is maybe not optimally used, but we know that that may have been somehow emergence of lenalidomide resistance. But that study is now awaiting the time points at which evaluation of impact of carfilzomib on progression-free survival will be looked at first. I think that the first time point when it will be happening is sometimes early next year, and we will be waiting for that study results. I'm very anxious to see those results. Essentially very much convinced that this is likely to be a positive study, but we'll see how quickly we can see it.
I'm trying to think if RVD has been compared in a phase 3 trial to RD.
It was. There was an ongoing cooperative group study which have looked at, they call it VRD, it was a little bit different design versus RD, and that study, I believe, have completed also enrollment in newly diagnosed patients in a similar setting. I want to maybe mention, which we have not really stressed, that VRD or RVD have been, as we have discussed at the beginning, associated with difficulty of giving this three-drug regimen for a longer period of time at optimal doses. We can manage it, but on RVD, as we reported in the paper, eventually 80% of patients have developed some level of peripheral neuropathy. It was mostly limited to grade 1 and 2 after median of 8 cycles, but still fairly significant, which gives you a sense that that strategy of extended treatment as RVD has some limitations, and at some point people will be requiring to go to single agent lenalidomide, and that eventually will be limiting impact of proteasome inhibitor in that type of strategy.
So I can already imagine oncologists driving in their car listening to this, and I know what they're thinking, which is, well, is CRD going to be compared to RVD?
That study is, I believe, approved by CTEP and is planned to be conducted in ECOG. I think that those details of the study are potentially being worked out. The question is, from my point, and this is my personal point of view, is this study absolutely needed at this time? We have not compared RVD to VDT, and we know that from our own experience, we could make the decision to move to RVD, which was better tolerated than VDT.
And we know ourselves, and we've surveyed people for years now, that RVD is being used. And I would guess you use it yourself in your own practice.
Absolutely. And I have used at some point until RVD signal was determined, VDT as my primary initial choice of clinical trial. So that eventually will be something which we have to think about, and how important this study will be in the time when it will be finished. I'm not necessarily convinced. I think if I would be advocating what is needed, I think in a similar way as we have seen in the design of VRD versus lenalidomide dex, I think it is important to prove first whether addition of proteasome inhibitor gives any advantage over maybe milder and more patient-friendly treatment with lenalidomide dex. I am in the group of people who believe that three drugs will be better, but I honestly cannot tell until these studies are completed. Now, what if RVD versus lenalidomide dex is negative and doesn't show a significant difference between those two arms? Will we be going back to using lenalidomide dex? I don't think it is the right direction. That's why I'm thinking that having that type of evaluation done in the context of what we have learned from CRD, with possibility of treating patients for extended period of time with three drugs without transplant, even in transplant group, will be probably better way of looking what is the next step for CRD development.
Yeah, I'm thinking now with this paper coming out today in Blood in particular, and I'm imagining carfilzomib being FDA approved, and I'm wondering how many people outside a trial setting, including you, are going to just go ahead and start using CRD up front.
No, I probably shouldn't have said this because, you know, we have to respect what the label says, where to approve it and so forth, but we know that to some extent in the United States we have this ability to potentially using drugs off-label in some indications. So it's very clear disclosure that what I will say is sharing my personal opinion and experience with using a variety of these drugs and combinations. If I would like to come with the best strategy of treatment, I definitely would be choosing CRD as a therapy. I would have a hard time thinking, should I break the treatment and give transplant in the middle for transplant candidate and then resume CRD treatment? That question needs to be answered. But I think between RVD followed by transplant followed RVD and CRD without a transplant, I can see that we can do quite well with CRD, and why not to try something which I think is going to come up to be stronger.
So I want to get to the other issues in proteasome inhibitors, but you brought up the issue of transplant. It's come up a couple times. And I'm kind of curious where you are today. Again, there are trials out there, but outside a trial setting, in terms of the issue of transplant, there have been new data that have come out over the last year. I think I'm seeing investigators maybe more move towards transplant. Where are you right now on that issue?
If I don't have protocol like CRD, I still continue to use transplant as a consolidation in transplant candidates. My typical approach nowadays, looking at the data, would be RVD followed by transplant, followed by RV consolidation, as it is in this transplant arm of ongoing study, which is investigating this specific question. This is Dana-Farber and IFM, a French cooperative investigator-initiated study, over 1,000 patients to be enrolled, but rapidly enrolling, which is specifically asking this question. But until that study comes back with the result, I think we have ample evidence that transplant adds on top of even novel active regimens to at least efficacy and some studies progression-free survival. To use one or maybe two examples, VDT, Italian study published by Dr. Cavo already in Lancet, have shown that patients who were treated with VDT had statistically significant improvement of depth of response pre-transplant than control group Taldex. In a similar way, a control group in French study was bortezomib Dex. That also showed superior three-drug regimen pre-transplant. So many argued earlier, and we have actually seen that before, that transplant will kind of eliminate this difference. And we see to some extent decreasing the difference at the end of transplant in terms of response and depth of response. But the difference remains statistically significant in favor of three-drug regimen. And when you add on top of that consolidation, like in Cavo's study with VDT, then you eventually end up with really high rates of complete and near-complete responses and VGPR, which in his study, which was not necessarily designed to look how each component contributed to ultimate outcome, have shown improvement in progression-free survival in bortezomib arm of the sequential therapy compared to arm which was using thalidomide and dexamethasone without bortezomib.
So you mentioned post-transplant maintenance. What's your usual strategy there?
So semantics are important, and maintenance at this time, I think, has been given to either thalidomide or lenalidomide or bortezomib as a single agent. And maybe let's start what the data gives us. We have...
You also mentioned consolidation. That's an interesting term.
So consolidation has been used in one of the lenalidomide maintenance studies as initial post-transplant cytoreduction just for two cycles of lenalidomide dex at more optimal doses. I think that we'll get back to consolidation maybe if you don't mind in a moment, because I think that the data is very important. So there was six studies with thalidomide, don't forget about that, which have shown in principle that thalidomide can improve in patients who do not achieve complete response or very good partial response, for the most part, can improve progression-free survival And in 3 out of 6 studies, overall survival, which on some cases was borderline, but it was principal evidence of so-called maintenance working to improve outcome in these patients. We are now excited about lenalidomide as a maintenance, which, as I said, in French study was preceded by short consolidation with lenalidomide dex, to a widely positive study with regard to progression-free survival. What was new in these studies, and I think for me it was good enough to really switch my practice, was that lenalidomide has shown not only improvement in progression-free survival and one case overall survival, but that lenalidomide was beneficial in patients who have achieved complete response. So in fact, in all subgroups, which was not the case with thalidomide. And we know now that between those two drugs, thalidomide is clearly not addressing poor risk disease, whereas lenalidomide is. If not perfect, it is better drug in this regard. So maybe that's the difference. And maybe that's why we are seeing that type of outcome in all groups in lenalidomide. So that, in my opinion, is established. And the fact that one of these two studies shows superiority overall survival is ultimate evidence that that strategy is good. Now, there was a second malignancy issue which came with lenalidomide, which is real, we think, and we have to think about that, discuss it with the patients in the context of data. And then in the context that one study did not show overall survival benefit, but the consensus in myeloma community has emerged, which I maybe summarize briefly, that on risk-benefit ratio, the benefit of prolonging remission and possibly survival with lenalidomide maintenance outweighs the risk of second cancer. Vigilance and all related management issues are very critical. Many of these cancers were very manageable, and from statistical modeling, it doesn't look like they're impacting in a significant way survival of this group of patients. Now, consolidation. It's still early, and I have to say that my approach and my practice is consolidation followed by maintenance for the reasons which are following. We have learned from number of studies, not only from this French RD short consolidation, but also from a single-arm bortezomib consolidation study done in Scandinavian countries, from CAVO study, VDT consolidation, from French study, which was piloting RVD, ongoing randomized study, which showed that there is a deepening of the response if one uses fairly active treatment post-transplant. Dr. Barlogi and his group in Little Rock has championed that for a long time, and don't forget to give them credit for this strategy. They have believed in consolidation as an important adjunct to our overall sequential therapy. Now, truly, only Scandinavian studies show some impact on progression-free survival of that strategy. And otherwise, what we know is that there is a deepening of response and increased probability of achieving minimal residual disease negative status in patients who achieve consolidation. And we have statistical modeling that MRD, minimal residual disease, projects longer remission and longer survival. To me, I'm adding two dots together. If I can get more patients in MRD and it is shown to be predictor of longer remission and survival, why not to take the strategy? But I can see limitations, toxicities, lack of category one evidence at this point. So I think in practice, outside of academic center and outside of clinical trial, that may not necessarily be always applicable. And it has some risks. Patients have high risk of myelosuppression post-transplant with some of these regimens, like RVD consolidation, and one has to be careful how to use it.
So one final question about maintenance. When those two studies were published, and the second one was the CALGB study, the editorial brought up the issue of cost of lenalidomide maintenance and put some incredible numbers there actually in the editorial about the cost. How does it actually play out in practice?
Well, these are valid issues. And I will have to say that in this regard, we as researchers owe our societies and eventually patients to figuring out what is the optimal duration of maintenance so it will be providing benefit at beyond which point the benefit is either marginal or absent. And that's something which we don't know. In many of these studies, the duration of maintenance was indefinite. Although in French study, once they've learned about second malignancies, they stopped maintenance at some point. So I think that in the next few years, between variety of studies, we will learn whether one or two or indefinite treatment is needed. I think that costs will eventually come, but from our perspective, I think it is important to see where we can make a difference and we can extend lives of our patients and then figure out the costs and how we can make some of these patients maybe cured which some of us believe is happening in some of these strategies. So that's on a balance between costs and what we are discussing here.
Cure. In other words, being able to stop all therapy and patients okay. Or cure, having normal life expectancy, but still need to be treated.
So the first question, I think, is something which I struggle all the time. I know that some of my colleagues I hear frequently, maybe Dr. Barlogia, I'll bring his name again, bringing that issue from his total therapy approach. He believes from long observation of his patients that there is a good proportion and potentially increasing proportion of patients who are technically cured because their disease is not coming back. We don't know enough details whether these patients are continuously exposed to treatment or whether their treatment in great proportion have completely ceased. I follow some of these patients when they transfer to area where I practice, that some of them remain in established stringent complete responses for years to come, past 10 and more years. And if they are not cured, it would be difficult to say what cure is. Now, I think that for the most part, we still are in the stage that cure may be still in this gray zone between cure versus we are still in complete response, but we are keeping you on some extended treatment or maintenance or recurrent consolidation at some practice. Whether this is really absolutely required to keeping these patients in these long remissions, I don't know. I have to say that my observations are mixed here. I had not once or twice convinced myself that I have patients who definitely have been cured. We stopped treatment and not that this has any statistical power, what I say at this point, but in recent few cases, it was very disappointing to see that some of these patients do have recurrence of disease at the time, and I've seen that their disease have been in stringent complete response for extended period of time of years from the start of treatment. On the other hand, I want to bring CRD again. I have not mentioned that in my description, but we have measured minimal residual disease in our patients. In fact, 22 of the patients suspected with complete response had a multicolor flow cytometry evaluation of MRD, and 91% of them had no evidence of residual disease. After a median of 9 months, so it's really a very short period of observation, what we are observing is something from my perspective new. We write about that in the paper, is that patients who achieve stringent complete response, appear to stay at the time when we make this analysis, all of them stayed in stringent complete response, meaning that we don't see any type of phenomenon which we frequently see with other regimens. The patient is in stringent response, say, for 2 or 3 months, then a spike appears for a while on immunofixation, then disappears again while continuing treatment. That type of situation in CRD, once patient got into this stringent CR, they seem to be staying there. And that, for me, is real hope that maybe some of these patients truly have some chances of eliminating the disease, achieving the cure.
So I'm going to finish out talking about MLN, the oral compound. But first, you referred to the potential to use subcutaneous bortezomib. And I'm curious, in your own practice, what you're doing, not only about using subcutaneous bortezomib, but also weekly versus biweekly.
So starting from subcutaneous, the data is for relapse disease. And it's clear that efficacy and progression-free survival is identical, toxicity is lower. Once I've learned that, and we establish, even before FDA approval, that it can be done based on this data in our institution, I pretty much switch every patient to sub-Q bortezomib. I believe this is the way to go, especially in a current environment where we need to keep patients on treatment longer and avoiding toxicity, so those doses are not attenuated too early is important. But I hear some of my colleagues cautioning that we don't know enough about efficacy of sub-Q bortezomib in frontline setting or in aggressive disease or in very advanced relapse disease, and some anecdotal observations are brought, which I don't know whether they have any significance. I think I set them aside at the moment. It's not changing my practice. I still use subcutaneous bortezomib in all of my patients based on the data. Data is clear-cut from published Morrow paper.
But upfront?
Including upfront. Now, I want to say that there is one aspect of maintenance which we have not discussed. I kind of had missed opportunity to say about that, but bortezomib has not really established well as a maintenance drug, but number of studies in non-transplant and transplant setting have provided at least signal or indication, and maybe not as clear-cut against placebo comparison, that bortezomib may potentially contribute to improvement in progression-free survival. whether only alone, like in Hovon study, or in combination, like in Palumbo study. That's something to be determined. But I think it is appealing to know that bortezomib can be used for an extended period of time without risking as highly neurotoxicity when it's used sub-Q. So in this setting, it probably will be more appealing definitely to use it once we have clear data that it makes sense to use bortezomib. Now, you ask about schedule. Many countries and many investigators, particularly in Europe, for reasons which are complex, have almost completely switched to using bortezomib weekly, particularly in elderly patient population. And there is a very important article by Dr. Palumbo in one of the recent issues of Blood, which is addressing our limitation of treating particularly elderly patients. There will be good guidance. I would refer your participants and listeners and viewers to that particular paper. I think my approach is as follows. In oncology, we are trained to be able to make assessments on fairly regular basis on clinic visits and in between where to make those modifications. There are very good dose modification guidelines, and we know that there is some edge of twice a week bortezomib versus once a week bortezomib. And when this edge is lost, if you overlook ability to reduce the dose and then ask patient to break the treatment for extended period of time, which eventually may end up that at the end of 4 years, those who started in twice weekly will have as much bortezomib as those who started it weekly, as Dr. Palumbo reported. But I think in good medical practice, it is possible to have some period of run twice a week, especially in younger patients, to get as much out of efficacy of this drug as possible, but carefully assessing patients with staff managing this patient to pull back based on current guidelines to weekly, sooner rather than later, and in this way, potentially extending life of this drug for these patients.
So what about the oral proteasome inhibitor, MLN9708?
There was an update at this ASCO Dr. Loniel presented, which have shown that the drug is active in advanced patients as a single agent. Activity measured as PR was about 13%. But there was a clear indication that the drug on its own is very active. And we already discussed some toxicity profiles. So in a way, whether it's meeting the threshold of new drug as a potential replacement for bortezomib, that's something which is to be determined. I think what is exciting to me, and I have to say that I have not participated in studies with MLN and lenalidomide and dex in newly diagnosed myeloma, but we now have this study open in our center, and I'm interested in participating in this study because what I have seen is that MLN9708 in combination with lenalidomide dex, the schedule, whether weekly or twice a week, has to be determined, again, in the context of toxicity. But there is an excellent record of activity for this combination. In fact, probably in the top three, I would say, including CRD, RVD, and now MLN9708 plus Lendex. The numbers were small. Last update was from ASH and at this meeting. But I think we can see that this is potentially powerful combination with maybe more favorable profile than RVD. And with ability to use these three drugs as oral regimen. And company, which is also marketing bortezomib, has convinced themselves to invest in development of this drug without even having any phase two studies in relapse patients. We are now observing that MLN with lenalidomide dex is moved to not only single-arm studies in frontline setting, but also to randomized study against lenalidomide dex on the other arm for patients who are newly diagnosed as well as in relapse patients. So I think there is a potential that even if this drug will not be superior to bortezomib because of toxicity profile and convenience, that this is maybe one of the most exciting developments in myeloma treatment. I would put this at the same level as some bias as I feel a CRD combination have brought in terms of my enthusiasm.
So I know you're about to chair a session and give a discussion of several papers on new agents in myeloma, and one of those studies looks at the monoclonal antibody elotuzumab. Any comments?
Of all the antibodies I'll be discussing, in fact, in a couple of hours, most probably advanced in development of antibodies in myeloma, elotuzumab has come with very impressive data for combination with lenalidomide dex. Combination with bortezomib, just published, have been also promising. But for theoretical consideration, and as we see in clinic, combining elotuzumab with lenalidomide was very powerful. In fact, we have not seen in relapse and relapse refractory setting that level of activity as we have been reported at ASCO oral session, the level of activity which we have seen. In fact, it will be reported today by Dr. Morrow. So achieving 90% response rate and extending progression-free survival to possibly beyond 18 months. And I would like to remind viewers that lenalidomide and dexamethasone median progression-free survival was in the range between 11 and 13 months. For those which was selected for randomized study, actually median progression-free survival was not reached and it's longer than 18 months. So we have really great signal in terms of efficacy and great signal in terms of progression-free survival. And not surprisingly, that drug is now recruiting sites for combination randomized study with Lendex. Control arms will be in both settings, newly diagnosed and relapsed lenalidomide dex. So that's probably most two exciting drugs which we have currently in development.
Do you ever, walking down Michigan Avenue, have fantasies of CRD elotuzumab?
Not only I have fantasies, I submitted a proposal of that study already year and a half ago. That's something which I believe should and will be done at some point. Whether this is to be done now or later, I think there are some valid concerns that do we know enough about that? Should we start with RVD and elotuzumab first and then go to CRD elotuzumab? I think this is the direction which we'll be going. I know of a number of proposals which have been either pre-approved or approved for RVD. So that type of strategy will be coming, and I completely agree with you. We need force partner, and the moment that force partner may replace transplant and get people into deeper and longer responses and maybe even cure.